Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
I truly believe that 50 years from now, historians are going to look back at this moment and say, that's the moment America began to win the competition of the 21st century.
The $1.2 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, signed into law by President Biden on Monday, is by almost every measure enormous. It's been called generation-defining by infrastructure analysts. It touches every infrastructure sector, from transportation to water to broadband to new energy sources.
It's also going to make it possible for Americans to get off the sidelines and into the game of manufacturing solar panels, wind turbines, batteries to store energy and power for electric vehicles, including electric school buses, which will mean millions of children will no longer inhale the dangerous diesel fumes that come out of the buses. For real. It's a big deal.
There's also another player in America's energy future tucked into the bill, one that doesn't get talked about a lot, but already produces about 20% of the nation's electricity and stands to receive the largest flow of federal dollars the sector has seen in decades. Nuclear power. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Infrastructure Act directs $6 billion towards preserving existing nuclear power plants that right now provide half of the country's carbon-free electricity. That's what makes the Biden administration keen on keeping nuclear power as part of America's clean energy future, as Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said at the UN Climate Conference in Glasgow.
We are very bullish on these advanced nuclear reactors. We have, in fact, invested a lot of money in the research and development of those. We are very supportive of that.
The average commercial nuclear power plant in this country is about 40 years old. But nuclear technology has been developing apace. Those advanced reactors Granholm mentioned? Well, the Infrastructure Act targets several billion dollars towards two companies specifically, TerraPower, founded by Bill Gates, and Maryland-based X Energy. Both promise they can have their advanced reactors up and running by 2028, pumping a total of 665 megawatts of carbon-free electricity into the grid.
We have designed a brand new type of reactor that's called the XU100. It's a high-temperature, gas-cooled, small modular reactor, and it produces 200 megawatts of thermal power, that's heat, that turns into 80 megawatts of electric power. And we'll deploy those typically in four packs, so that gives you a net of 320 megawatts electric.
X Energy's Benjamin Renke. The company is ready to build one of its modern reactors in eastern Washington state.
It's small and easy to build, so we're going to be able to manufacture the components and build them much more rapidly. We'll have less concrete and less steel in the reactor than you would in a traditional light water reactor that's deployed today. And that means that the reactor will be much more economic to build and operate.
X Energy also plans to build its new reactor near the Columbia Generating Station, an existing nuclear facility 10 miles north of Richland, Washington.
The site's important because it has had years of work in site preparation. There's a lot of environmental work that's already been done, and it's going to allow us to deploy this reactor faster than we would be able to deploy it anywhere else in the world.
However, there are key issues that always confront the nuclear industry: waste and safety. Renke insists his advanced reactor, the XE100, cannot melt down.
The XE100 uses a type of fuel called TRISO-fuel. Without getting into the really nerdy details of why that fuel is cool, today the Department of Energy calls it the most robust fuel on Earth. As opposed to a traditional uranium rod that's inside of today's reactors, this fuel is packed inside of a pebble that's about the size of what fits in your hand. And that pebble is filled with materials that can't melt until you attain really, really high temperatures. And those temperatures can't be seen inside of our reactor. So starting with the fuel, the reactor has really a couple of important safety features that make it walkaway safe and inherently safe and cannot melt down. Number one, that fuel can't melt itself. And number two, the physics of the reactor shuts the reactor off in an accident scenario. So there's not a need for human intervention to be able to shut the reactor down and make sure that it ends up in a safe standby state.
So that's quite a list of promises. Safe. He also says it's on time, or will be constructed on time and on budget, other issues that have continuously dogged the nuclear power industry. Nevertheless, as you heard, through that infrastructure bill, the United States government is taking a chance on them.
So people often ask, is this really realistic? Are we actually going to be able to deploy an advanced reactor by 2027? The answer is yes. We are as ready as you can be to deploy this, as shovel ready as you can be today. We have a great partner that today operates a nuclear power plant in the area. We have a local population with the skills to build this plant. We've already engaged many of the skilled labor unions in the area, and they're excited to build this plant.
That was Benjamin Reinke, Senior Director for Corporate Strategy at the Nuclear Fuel and Engineering Design Company, X-Energy. Well, today, we're going to take an even closer look at the Infrastructure Act and nuclear power. And we're going to ask, what role should nuclear power play, if any, in America's clean energy future? Well, when the DOE was awarding early research and development grants to X-Energy, Ernest Moniz was the Secretary of Energy at the time. He's a physicist by training and is now back at MIT, where he's been a faculty member since 1973, and he joins us now. Secretary Moniz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. Pleasure to be with you.
So first of all, I wonder if you could just, you know, for we lay people out here, I wonder if you could just briefly describe what you think the most significant differences are between sort of the older style nuclear reactors that we're all familiar with and these new advanced reactors. What makes them so different?
Magna, if you don't mind, let me give a little context before going to that question. Until recently, in addressing climate change, there's been a thought that the variable sources like wind and solar could do the entire job. In the recent years, what's happened is that we see for a reliable system, we're also going to need a substantial contribution from carbon-free sources that also can produce electricity all the time, when you want it, where you want it. That's really the context why nuclear power is being viewed so favorably in many quarters today, because it's essentially on all the time with carbon-free power. Mm. Now, today's reactors are these very large reactors. They're over 1,000 megawatts of electricity production, typically. They are so-called light water reactors. We could go into that, but fundamentally, these reactors are still expensive to build. The ones that are being built today are well over budget, and they are based upon this technology that was really developed by Admiral Rickover and for submarines. Today's reactors, the ones that you're talking about today, for example, the X-Energy reactor, are very different technologies, number one. Some of that was explained in terms of the very different fuel mm-hmm. and cooling. There's no light water in it. Secondly, they are much smaller. They're called modular. And in addition to what was said about why the costs hopefully will come out to be much less per megawatt, there's also a chicken and egg issue that if one builds a lot of them, the idea will be to build the entire nuclear guts of the reactor in a manufacturing environment, uh-huh. in a factory. And that will be another huge leg up for getting the cost down.
Right. So in an ideal future here, you're talking about the ability to perhaps put these smaller modular reactors in places in the country that have had historically a harder time getting access to reliable sources of power. Is that right?
Well, reliable sources of power, but also I can tell you that when you have to put together a very, very large nuclear power station, getting the skill set in the workforce is not simple. For example, today there are these two reactors being built in Georgia of the traditional type. And I know that one of the biggest challenges is getting enough electricians to be there. And of course, COVID makes it even more complicated. So there are many challenges for this for the current paradigm, which have led to cost and schedule problems. This potential for a manufacturing environment is really a big deal.
Right. You know, a little earlier, Secretary Moniz, you said that hopefully these new advanced reactors could be manufactured, you know, at budget, because historically the traditional nuclear facilities that we're familiar with are almost always massively over budget. I will note that that word hopefully is doing a lot of work.
Right? Absolutely. I chose that word carefully, and it's because there's no doubt that there are many reasons to believe that these will be produced much more economically. But, you know, I'm just the kind of person who says, you got to show me. And that's why having the infrastructure bill supporting the advanced reactor development program and getting some of these reactors out is so important.
Right.
You got to demonstrate it.
Right. So that's key, right? Because at this point in time, we have 55 nuclear power plants across the United States that currently exist, the older style ones, 93 reactors in those 55 plants. These advanced reactors that we're talking about, we don't even have one fully yet that's been proven to be functional and operational and cost effective. But how long do you think it might take before that kind of evidence or data comes in?
Well, I think, again, these reactors, the two that that are supported by the current advanced reactor program, hopefully will have the first reactors. Well, they're aiming for 2027. I would be happy to see it in this decade, operating, providing the data that everyone needs, the technical people, but also the investors, the utilities who would have to order these reactors they'll understand in this decade how these reactors work, what they cost. That's really important. Then what we would like to see is again, enough orders to justify building a manufacturing environment.
Yeah. Secretary Moniz, hang on here for just a second. Sorry to have to cut you off there. It's just that we've got to take a quick break. We'll talk a lot more about the role that nuclear power should play, if any, in America's clean energy future, and what efforts the Biden administration, through the new Infrastructure Act, is putting into the nuclear industry. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at a part of the recently signed Infrastructure Act, where several billion dollars, many billion dollars actually, are going towards the nuclear power industry. And we're asking, what role should nuclear power play, if any, in America's clean energy future? And I'm joined today by Ernest Moniz. He was the Secretary of Energy from 2013 to 2017, a physicist by training and a professor at MIT now. And Secretary Moniz, we'll get back to these advanced reactors here in just a second, but I do want to get your view right now of the existing sort of fleet of nuclear reactors that we have in the United States, because I think the last new reactor that was brought online was 2016, and before that in the early 90s. So there's been quite a bit of time that's passed since we've had new facilities constructed in the United States, meaning Are most of the reactors out there, or at least the facilities, sort of nearing the end of their design lifespan right now?
Well, as you said earlier, by the way, I should add, Magna, that there are two reactors in Georgia that should come on in 2022 and 2023. Mm-hmm. But that's probably the end of the line for those very, very large light water reactors in the United States, at least for a while. The current reactors are, as you said, a critical part of carbon-free electricity in the United States today. The Biden administration and, of course, the recent Glasgow climate change meeting have emphasized that we need a 45 to 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 if we are to have any chance of staying below 2 degrees centigrade. That's the context in which the $6 billion is being provided to basically make sure that existing reactors that might otherwise be shut down prematurely continue to function. Now, prematurely means, as you said again earlier, 40 years is a fairly typical lifetime right now for these reactors, but most of them have successfully received licenses to add on an additional 20 years. So with those 20 years, this reactor fleet will be, at least can be, operating into the mid-century timeframe. And besides that, there's now even discussion of adding an additional 20 years to go to 80-year lifetimes. So this is another critical piece of the puzzle. And if we lose, there are considered to be as much as 30,000 megawatts of nuclear reactors in the United States today at some risk of closing down relatively soon. That would make meeting these goals for 2030 for carbon-free electricity essentially impossible.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we are receiving some feedback from listeners who have some doubts about the nuclear industry in this country. For example, Steve says, show me one nuclear energy plant that was not subsidized to the extreme by taxpayers. Nuclear equals waste and corruption. And of course, right now we're talking about this in the context of, you know, that historic infrastructure act that was just signed this week. We're talking about taxpayer dollars going towards that $6 billion to keep the existing fleet safe and functioning until the newer technologies can be proven. I mean, what would you say to Steve?
Well, I think that this is, first of all, we should emphasize this was a bipartisan bill, at least when it was in the Senate. We've seen a strange evolution, clearly. The issue is that there are significant market imperfections in the electricity markets today, which are not giving proper credit to, again, what I called firm power. That is electricity that can be produced all the time, anytime, anywhere. That is increasingly viewed as central to maintaining a reliable and resilient electricity system while going to low carbon. Therefore, the infrastructure bill should be viewed, I think, in that context. It is providing the part of the system that will be needed as wind and solar expand. Mm-hmm. Wind and solar will need to be probably 3x what in 2030 what it is today. Mm. That's very, very important. But in order to enable that, we will need this firm power. Nuclear is certainly the prevalent way of producing that today.
Yeah. So my last question for you then, Secretary Moniz, is you're clear, as you just said, about the place that you believe nuclear power has in America's carbon-free future. That's what we mean when we say clean energy.
Right.
But you know, there are still many people out there, organizations that have fresh memory from decades past about why they don't want to see nuclear power as any part of America's energy mix. I mean, Greenpeace USA still has a very clear statement about this. They say nuclear power is dirty, dangerous, and expensive. Say no to new nukes. Nuclear energy has no place in a safe, clean, sustainable future. It is both expensive and dangerous, and just because nuclear pollution is invisible doesn't mean it's clean. What do you think?
The First of all, I am driven, as is clear, by the greenhouse gas problem and addressing global warming and climate change. I would say that there was a much more prevalent view among environmental organizations, say 10 years ago, in terms of not having nuclear as part of the solution. That has changed dramatically with many, many environmental organizations supporting nuclear power because of its low carbon characteristics. Now, they may not be doing that with great enthusiasm, but they realize climate change is the problem of our time. And we need every tool at our disposal to address that. It's about the emissions, not about one's favorite or disfavored technology. And I think that's the way we have to look at this. It's all about getting to low carbon. And low carbon electricity is the lead horse, if you like, in decarbonizing the entire economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have another listener, Stephen Schmidt, who says global warming is an existential threat. We can't afford not to use all available technologies. Nuclear cannot meet all of our needs, but it is the best replacement for coal. And on that note, Secretary Moniz, yes. I know we need to let you go here, but Ernest Moniz, former Secretary of Energy from 2013 to 2017, also a physicist by training and a professor at MIT. Secretary Moniz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's listen to what President Biden said about America's clean energy future and the climate emergency at the Glasgow Climate Conference the beginning of this month.
We meet with the eyes of history upon us and the profound questions before us. It's simple. Will we act? Will we do what is necessary? Will we seize the enormous opportunity before us? Or will we condemn future generations to suffer?
Well, joining us now is Allison McFarland. She's former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, currently a professor and director of the University of British Columbia's School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. Professor McFarland, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I know that you have a list of concerns about the future promise of these advanced reactors. What's number one on your list?
Well, let me just first say that I think nuclear power right now plays an absolutely essential role in carbon-free electricity supply in the United States and in other places around the world. And I'm not advocating getting rid of it at all, because we desperately need that carbon-free electricity. But if we're thinking about the new reactor designs that you talked about with Secretary Moniz, we want to make sure that they're actually going to be a real possibility and a worthwhile investment. And I think we need to really face head on some of the challenges that are heading down the pike towards these designs. Mm. And the biggest challenge for them is really going to be the biggest challenge for everything nuclear, and that's economics. That's the cost.
Okay, so tell us more about that, right? Because I actually haven't been given, I haven't stated yet a specific dollar figure. I think I've been seeing something like the plant that may be constructed in Wyoming by TerraPower is like a $4 billion price tag, right?
Well, you haven't seen a price because nobody knows what the price is. And just remember that the plants that are being constructed in Georgia right now, which are, I don't know, 90% complete or so, we still don't know the final price tag for those. But those started off with a much lower price tag, and now they were originally two plants for $14 billion, and now we are looking at $28.5 billion for two plants. And we haven't seen the end of that yet. So we don't know how much these plants will cost, especially the newer designs, which are honestly not newer designs. They're actually old designs. Some of them are 70 years old. They've been taken off the shelf and dusted off and rethought a bit. But these designs are, there are many parts of them that we don't know what the costs will be.
Okay, can I just jump in here for a second? So tell me more about some of So you just said some of the new designs are dusted off old designs. You mean for the facility as a whole? Because I was focusing for maybe erroneously just on the reactor technology. But of course,
the reactor technology.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But both. They're supposed to be smaller, safer, modular. That sounds all new to me versus the older designs that we're familiar with.
The idea of modularity is new and factory built is sort of new. But this is, again, where we run into challenges where we really have to confront them. The idea of factory built reactors is a good one, maybe, but that's what was used in the Georgia reactors. And frankly, that's what bankrupted Westinghouse. So I don't know if you remember a few years ago, Westinghouse went bankrupt, and that was largely because of this plant, this factory that they had in Lake Charles, Louisiana, which failed to make the parts, the modules for the Georgia reactors properly. They couldn't get the welding right, and the modules would have to be rewelded at the Georgia site. And this happened for years. Uh-huh. So there are real challenges with getting nuclear build correct. And that's in part because the quality of nuclear build has to be extremely high.
Okay. So Professor McFarlane, hang on here for just a second, because there are several main issues that I think we need to sort of think through from multiple angles. The price tag. We'll also talk about waste. We'll talk about safety as well. But I want to get another view on this price tag issue. So I'd like to bring into the conversation now Rita Baranwal. She's former assistant secretary at the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy and now vice president of nuclear energy and chief nuclear officer at the Electric Power Research Institute. Rita Baranwal, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so lots of issues to dig into here. First of all, just give us your take on the very real concern that Professor McFarlane is bringing about. We don't even know how much these new reactors might cost, whether they can be built, at budget and on time. I mean, there's a pretty aggressive timetable that's been laid out for the construction of some of these sort of test plants. What do you think?
I agree with what former Commissioner McFarlane has said in terms of the concerns. There are ranges that have been put around the capital costs as well as the overnight costs for some of these reactors and the LCOE target ranges. With respect to what's happening in Georgia, those are essentially a first of a kind for our country in this industry. It was decades prior to that where we had new reactors being built. And so we had lost some of that supply chain robustness. So if we apply the lessons that we have learned, and we have learned many, through this new construction, this new phase, we're going to apply those lessons learned to the new builds that we heard Dr. Reinke talk about from X-Energy, as well as the other developers that are pursuing new builds. So I think as long as we are mindful of what we have gone through over the past several years, we will be successful in new builds in this country.
Okay.
In addition—
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
I was going to say, in addition to the builds occurring in the U.S., I have to say, the world is watching, and there is so much interest and emphasis around deploying new nuclear in many other countries for them to also reach their decarbonization targets. They're watching U.S. technology and are waiting for it to be deployed because they don't necessarily want to be the first in line. They'll take the second, they'll take the 10th. They just want to be the first. So us deploying new nuclear also is imperative for us to maintain in the United States our technology leadership.
Mm. Professor McFarlane, I'm going to come back to you in just a second. But Rita Baranwal, let me ask you, I've been seeing here that there's, in a sense, a timeline set for some of these new test reactors to be manufactured, constructed and brought online by 2027. Do you really think that's doable, that deadline?
I do, because I was one of the people that set that deadline. And the reason I set that aggressive timeline is that We do believe as an industry that technology is there, as we've already discussed. It's applying advances in materials, in sensors, in modeling and simulation, in digitization to those tried and true coolant technologies. And if we put this timeline out there, and I do think that developers will be able to meet that in a collaborative sense. So it's not just the developers operating in a vacuum. It's developers with owner operators along with regulatory bodies. All of that collaboration has to happen early. And we have encouraged that as an industry, and I'm seeing that.
Right.
Well, I think that will lead to success.
So, Professor McFarlane, I appreciate you listening here with me. We've got about 30 seconds before our next break, but I wanted to give you a quick chance to respond to Rita Baranwal, and then we'll, of course, pick up the conversation when we come back from the break. But go ahead.
Great. Thanks. I think Rita's exactly right about being mindful of the lessons of the new builds, not just in the U.S., but in Europe as well. And I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing that mindfulness of, oh, look, you know, it can be difficult to produce things in a factory. What do we need to learn? Let's look at this carefully. I don't see that.
Well, we are talking about what role nuclear power should play, if any, in America's clean energy future. And the fact that the Biden administration and through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act just signed this week is really throwing many billions of dollars into the industry to keep it as a major part of America's clean energy plan going forward. So we'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about nuclear power and what role it should play, if any, in America's clean energy future. I'm joined today by Allison McFarlane. She's former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Rita Baranwal also joins us as well. She's former assistant secretary at the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy. And On Point listeners, you are a feisty lot. I love it. Look at all these comments coming in. Gary Constantine says, the only rational and logical approach to moving measurably away from fossil fuel energy production is nuclear energy. Gary Wilhide, I think, says, how do you warn people 1,000 years into the future that nuclear waste is dangerous? Someone calling themselves Trying to Work says, nuclear is not clean. We do not need energy from nuclear. The West needs to use less energy. Well, so in addition to all those views about what our clean energy mix should be regarding nuclear power, there are always going to be two other additional issues. That is safety and waste. So let's talk a little bit about the industry's past.
The accident occurred here at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, a dozen miles south of Harrisburg. At about 4 o'clock this morning, two water pumps that help cool reactor number 2 shut down. Officials say some 50 to 60,000 gallons of radioactive water escaped into the reactor building.
От Совета министров СССР.
An official announcement from the Council of Ministers. There has been an accident at the Chernobyl atomic power station. One of the atomic reactors was damaged. The consequences of the accident are being taken care of. Help is being given to the victims of the accident. A government commission has been set up.
Our third story out front, a nuclear crisis. Tonight, Japan on the verge of classifying a toxic water leak at the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant, a level 3 serious incident. That would be the highest warning since the massive meltdown following the earthquake and tsunami, those images now so famous around the world.
Fukushima Daiichi, 2011, Chernobyl, 1986, Three Mile Island, 1979. Now, Allison McFarlane, earlier in the show, we heard Benjamin Reinke from X-Energy say that the type of fuel that they use in these new advanced reactors is totally safe because he insisted it cannot suffer a catastrophic failure and melt down. I just wonder, what do you think about the safety of these new the new fuels and technologies?
I think there are, again, challenges with safety. There may be some advantages to these new designs, or new in quotes designs, but there are also challenges, and there are things that we don't yet understand. Let me just say, the way engineering works is that you design a technology, maybe on your computer these days, right? And then you build a small model of it. And when you build the small model, you realize there were things that were wrong in your original design, and you fix them. And then you build a full-scale model. And when you go up to full scale, you realize there were some things that were wrong, and you have to go back and fix them. It's not different for nuclear reactors. And the safety part of this will come out when we build the small scale model and then the full scale model. Now, the issue is, I'm going to take us back to the cost issue, because it costs a lot of money to build those models, to do that engineering, to understand some of these issues. Mm. And so we have to be mindful of that ahead of time.
Yeah. So Rita Baranwal, this is one of the interesting conundrums about nuclear power, right? Because to Allison McFarlane's point, safety has to be proven in situ. It actually can't really be fully confidently modeled, in the lab. Because I was thinking, Fukushima happened because a plant was faced with a situation well outside anything an engineer would think to design for, right? A tsunami that floods the plant and causes a meltdown. Chernobyl, bad design. Three Mile Island, I think if I remember correctly, was human error. So how, for these advanced reactors, these new technologies, how and when can they prove themselves to be safe if we're also living in a world where those extreme outside of design events, if they happen, due to the nature of nuclear power, nuclear technology, could result in a terrible disaster?
So, as we've discussed, actual empirical testing is necessary for these new fuel technologies. As somebody who started their career designing new fuel for the U.S.'s nuclear navy, it does take time. It does take testing to prove these new fuels out. But as Dr. Reinke mentioned, the TRISO fuel, the reason it's melt-proof is because of the material that's used in the development of that fuel. You have silicon carbide, which has such a high melting temperature. It's beyond that of anything the reactor will ever see. There's also redundancy of design. So you have layer upon layer of safety built into the nuclear fuel.
Can we talk a little bit more about this TRISO fuel? Because it's absolutely fascinating to me. They're little tiny pellets, right? Like the size of a billiard ball.
They're even smaller. Oh. They're BBs compacted into, one example is a billiard ball, like you said. But you take little BBs and you compact them into a billiard ball.
And then you, oh, go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I was going to say, and then you take multiple billiard balls, and that's what provides you, as you have the fissioning occurring in the reactor, the heat that heats, in layman's terms, the steam for a light water reactor type of design, or the other coolant, so a molten salt coolant or a gas coolant.
Mm, but the actual material, though, it still has to be fissile material, right? So we're still talking about uranium being part of what makes up TRISO fuel.
That's correct.
So we have to get the uranium from somewhere.
Correct. Right. I mean, there are supplies around the world. It is a element that's mined.
Okay. Well, so Allison McFarlane, though, I mean, we've got listeners writing to us saying why is the only logical approach to use exotic elements available in certain places on Earth, but nowhere in North America? It doesn't make sense to listener Steve. I mean, is the fact that we'd still be relying on uranium that has to be mined somewhere else, is that a problem?
No. let me make a couple of points here. And I'm trained as a geologist, so I can tell you that uranium is ubiquitous in the rocks and in actually all the oceans. So there's no problem with uranium supply. Plenty of that. The problem with almost all of these new designs, whether they're the X-Energy design or any of the others, is that they want to use a kind of uranium that's enriched in the isotope uranium-235 to a higher percent than the reactors that are now operating use. And we don't have any facilities in the United States that can do that enrichment right now. And so we have a chicken and egg problem, because the people who could build the facility and make this highly enriched uranium, or it's actually called high assay, low enriched uranium, HALEU. The people who could do that say, well, we don't want to build our facility unless we know we're going to have customers. And the people who are going to potentially supply the money to build these new reactors say, we don't want to supply the money to build these new reactors unless we know we have a fuel supply. So we have a real problem there. Mm. And we don't have any facilities yet that can fabricate this. So we have a real supply chain issue on the front end that we need to grapple with.
So isn't that the very role of government, though, in exactly those kinds of situations, to break the chicken and egg question and just get the process started?
It can be, but if we go back to the infrastructure bill, I don't see the infrastructure bill addressing some of those issues well enough.
I see. Can I just step outside of the confines of this conversation for a second and say, how cool is it that I am talking to two brilliant women scientists, a geologist and a nuclear scientist? And I feel like I'm, we're in good hands if people like you are helping us think through what we need to do about energy moving forward. And I'm just always going to be a robust booster of women in the sciences. So get off my soapbox there for a second. But Rita Baranwald,
thanks, Meghna.
did you want to respond to what Professor McFarland just said?
I do agree, but I also want to add that there is public support for fuel supplier of high assay LEU, high assay low enriched uranium. And so the government, the U.S. government, has started to fund a startup, not a startup in the entrepreneurial sense, but for a facility to start fabricating this type of fuel, precisely for the reasons that Professor McFarland stated. It's a chicken and an egg scenario, and so the government has said, DOE has said, we'll start this process now. The private developers have to come in and put some skin in the game and say, yes, we want some of that fuel supply. So that has begun as of a few years ago. And that's the U.S. source, but there are also existing sources internationally. So if need be, we can look outside the U.S. too.
Okay.
Right now, the main existing source internationally is Russia.
And therefore?
We don't have the best relationship with Russia right now.
Okay. There are facilities, for example, in the UK that can fabricate high assay LEU that are equipped to, not that they have to do research, et cetera, to get started to do that. It's a matter of supply and demand. And so if that demand signal comes across their radar, they will absolutely produce that high assay LEU. The capability is there.
Again, though, we'll have to something has to generate that demand signal, right? I mean, that's the kind of at one of the core issues here. Now, listen, we only have about 5 minutes left, so I want to touch on two things as we head towards the end of this truly fascinating conversation. And Professor McFarland, I'm going to turn to you for this one because you wrote an entire book about Yucca Mountain. It's called Uncertainty Underground, Yucca Mountain and the Nation's High Level and Nuclear Waste. Is nuclear waste also an area of concern for these advanced technology reactors?
Sure. It's an area of concern for all reactors. We still haven't solved the issue of what to do with the spent nuclear fuel that we have a lot of sitting around the United States. But honestly, that's a political problem. It's not a technical problem. But let me talk about these new reactor designs in specifically, because some of them produce spent fuel that is either not stable or will not be acceptable in a deep geologic repository and therefore will need to be processed. Mm. And some of them are electing to reprocess their spent fuel. And whenever you process spent fuel, you create a lot of other waste, a lot of low-level radioactive waste and intermediate-level radioactive waste, and that needs to go somewhere too. And by the way, coming back to the cost issue, if you have to process any of your spent fuel, it's going to be expensive.
Hmm. Well, so all this brings us back to the sort of core question that we're wrestling with this hour, and that is, what role should nuclear power play in America's, I keep calling it clean energy future. Some of our listeners don't like that. Steve is telling me, stop referring to nuclear energy as carbon-free. It takes a lot of petroleum-based fuel to get uranium out of the ground, to mine it out of the ground. So point taken. But the idea when we're talking about putting carbon into the air through the actual power that we're generating. I received a really interesting email from another listener who said, there's nothing perfect, essentially. He talked to me about the giant footprint needed for, say, wind or solar. And those are ostensibly clean energy sources, too. So it seems to me that we have a situation here where, really, we have a mix of a bunch of potentially useful, or we know they're going to be useful, but no one perfect solution. We have a mix of a lot of imperfect solutions because that is life. So we have to pick the best mix out of those imperfect solutions. And so, Rita Barenwald, I'll first turn to you here. How do we do that? How do we get to a place where we know what the best role for nuclear power should be in this mix of imperfect solutions?
I think recent studies have shown that in one's energy, well, specifically electricity portfolio, you know, you can have up to 80% renewable sources. That remaining 20%, I am convinced, needs to come from nuclear. The reliability, the resilience, the firm power that former Secretary Moniz talked about is what nuclear can provide. And frankly, there is enough of an energy demand pie for everybody, each of those clean energy sources. And I do think nuclear energy is a clean energy source. For each of those clean energy sources to have a slice of that pie, it is going to be such a heavy lift to decarbonize not only our electricity sector, but our transportation sector and our economy as a whole. We need every tool in the toolbox, and nuclear has to be one of those.
And Professor McFarland, I'll give you the last word on this.
Thanks, Meghna. I think you're absolutely right. I always tell my students when I teach energy policy that there's no silver bullet. There's no perfect energy source out there. And I'll also say that diversity of supply is exceptionally important. I completely agree with Rita on this. We have to have a supply that works within the electricity market that we have. And right now, the electricity market that we have in the United States is not favorable to nuclear power in many parts of the country. And we have to grapple with that. But in the end, right now, nuclear is providing important supply of carbon-free electricity. Whether it will continue to do so in the future, I don't know. And I don't think any of us know. Will carbon sequestration take over that role of baseload supply? I don't know. It's something that's going on, and we'll have to see what happens in the future.
Well, at least hopefully, using the same word that Secretary Moniz used earlier, in the next couple of years, we might be starting to get a little, at least a parts of the answers to what we don't yet know, right? And that's what it seems like the infrastructure bill and nuclear power might kickstart there a little bit. New Infrastructure Act, I should call it, because now it has officially been signed this week by President Biden. So Allison McFarland, former chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and currently a professor at the University of British Columbia's School of Public Policy, author of Uncertainty Underground, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
And Rita Barenwald, former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy and Vice President of Nuclear Energy and Chief Officer at the Electric Power Research Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
Also, women in science are great. Had to end the show with that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.